Today is Wednesday, September 29th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, efforts to raise U.S. debt ceiling fails for a second time.
Republicans in the U.S. Senate again blocked a bid to raise the federal debt ceiling on Tuesday, sending Democrats scrambling to avoid a government shutdown.
Plus, U.N. warns of starvation and death in Tigray.
Already we're seeing malnutrition levels going up. So what's called the global malnutrition level in Tigray now is over 22%.
Also, WHO finds evidence of horrific rape abuses in the DRC. Our top story today is in the U.S. U.S. Senate Republicans, for a second day in a row, blocked a bid by President Joe Biden's Democrats to head off a potentially crippling U.S. credit default as partisan tensions rattled an economy recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
Republicans in the U.S. Senate again blocked a bid to raise the federal debt ceiling on Tuesday, sending Democrats scrambling to avoid a government shutdown and a potentially crippling default. Borrowing authority is set to run out next month, and federal government funding is set to expire on Thursday, leaving lawmakers little time to avert a shutdown, which could leave hundreds of thousands of federal workers unemployed. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell reiterated on Tuesday that Democrats should be responsible for lifting the borrowing limit themselves without GOP support.
There is no chance, no chance, the Republican conference will go out of our way to help Democrats conserve their time and energy so they can resume ramming through partisan socialism as fast as possible.
Meanwhile, Democrats insist that some $5 trillion of the nation's debt came from Republican President Donald Trump's time in office. The standstill over the debt limit brings an additional challenge for Democrats, who are already at odds over President Joe Biden's trillion-dollar infrastructure package and an even larger social spending package. A government shutdown or default would be a huge blow for Democrats ahead of next year's congressional elections.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in Senate testimony with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, told lawmakers failing to lift the nation's borrowing limit would be a, quote, disastrous, unquote, event that would trigger, quote, a financial crisis and calamity, unquote. Conway G. Gittens of Reuters reports.
We're in the midst of a fragile but rapid recovery from the pandemic-induced recession.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell were back on Capitol Hill Tuesday. America's two top financial and economic leaders were supposed to be there to update the Senate Banking Committee on the economic rebound and the federal spending, known as the CARES Act, which fueled it. But the hearing quickly turned to the looming deadline for Congress to raise the nation's borrowing limit and what would happen if it doesn't.
America would default for the first time in history. The full faith and credit of the United States would be impaired, and our country would likely face a financial crisis and economic recession as a result. We must address this issue to honor commitments made by this and prior Congresses, including those made to address the health and economic impact of the pandemic. It's necessary to avert a catastrophic event for our economy.
Yellen repeatedly tried to make clear that raising the debt limit was needed to pay the bills that were already accrued and warned the Treasury will run out of ways to do so on October 18th. Republicans on the committee said by raising the debt limit now, it would only encourage Democrats to spend more and have vowed to vote against raising the debt limit, breaking with longstanding bipartisan tradition.
This would be a manufactured crisis we had imposed on this country, which has been going through a very difficult period, is on the road to recovery, and it would be a self-inflicted wound of enormous proportions.
Powell stayed out of the discussion on the debt limit, but did remark on what he thought the services sector and the economy at large needed to keep the rebound going.
In my view, the most important thing is to get control of the pandemic. That's what's keeping people out of sporting arenas and off of airplanes and out of restaurants and bars. And we saw that very clearly in the August payroll report, where job creation in these industries had gone from very strong for several months to zero in August. So it's really all about, at this point, getting the Delta variant and really, frankly, getting vaccination and immunity up higher.
Both will be back on Thursday to testify before the House Financial Services Committee.
That's Conway G. Gittens of Reuters. America's top military officer has described the Afghanistan evacuation as a, quote, logistics success, but a strategic failure, unquote. General Mike Miley, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, spoke at a contentious Senate hearing on the U.S. military's withdrawal and evacuation from Afghanistan. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob has the details.
The top U.S. general Tuesday bluntly assessing the Afghanistan evacuation mission.
It was a logistical success, but a strategic failure.
And the overall end of the war.
Outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure, the enemy is in charge in Kabul. There's no way else to describe that. That outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days.
Milley, along with Central Command Chief General Frank McKenzie, said they personally had wanted a minimum of 2,500 troops to remain.
My assessment was, back in the fall of 20, and it remained consistent throughout, that we should keep a steady state of 2,500, and it could bounce up to 3,500, maybe something like that, in order to move toward a negotiated, gated solution.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. And I also recommended earlier in the fall of 2020 that we maintain 4,500 at that time. Those are my personal views. I also have a view that the withdrawal of those forces would lead inevitably to the collapse of the Afghan military forces and eventually the Afghan government.
The general's assertions contrasted with those of President Joe Biden, who has said he did not recall any of his advisors urging him to keep a small U.S. military force in Afghanistan. The White House Tuesday again defending the decision to remove all troops.
And if we had kept 2,500 troops there, we would have increased the number of troops. We would have been at war with the Taliban. We would have had more U.S. casualties. That was a reality everybody was clear-eyed about.
Both Republicans and Democrats slammed the administration for leaving Americans and Afghan allies behind after the president said he would not do so. They also asked pointed questions on the future of the counter-terror war there.
Has the military's task to defeat terror threats from Afghanistan gotten harder?
Yes.
Does the Taliban and its other terror partners have more ability to train and prepare in Afghanistan now that we've left?
More ability, yes.
Are you confident that we can deny organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS the ability to use Afghanistan as a launch pad for terrorist activity?
I think that's yet to be seen.
The military has come under harsh criticism for its errant drone strike in the final days of the withdrawal that killed 10 civilians, a strike for which McKenzie has taken responsibility. The top defense officials also reiterated that U.S. intelligence had failed to anticipate the rapid fall of Kabul. But in their lessons learned, they had a message for America's civilian leaders.
So I would advise any leader, don't put date certains on end dates. Make things conditions-based. Two presidents in a row put dates on it.
An ousted Afghan leader, Ashraf Ghani.
And when your president leaves suddenly in the middle of a campaign for the capital, I think that finishes any chance at all you might have had of making a stand there.
Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations humanitarian chief calls the crisis in Ethiopia, quote, a stain on our conscience, unquote, as children and others starved to death in the Tigray region under what the UN calls a de facto government blockade of food, medical supplies, and fuel. In an interview with the Associated Press, Martin Griffiths issued one of the most sharply worded criticisms yet of the world's worst hunger crisis in a decade after nearly a year of war. He said memories of Ethiopia's 1980s farming, whose image shocked the world, are vivid in his mind. And quote, we fervently hope it's not happening at present, unquote.
It's always in the back of your mind, never mind in Ethiopia, but in any of these countries affected by prospects of famine, because famine is a phenomenon which now we understand better, that when famine kicks in, when it starts, it's viral. And the initial symptoms of that is people dying from disease, not from hunger, because it is the lack of food and the lack of proper nutrition erodes health, and we see the most vulnerable, children, of course, as well as pregnant or lactating mothers, dying first. That's what keeps people awake at night, is worrying about whether that's what is in prospect and in prospect soon. Well, already we're seeing malnutrition levels going up. So what's called the global malnutrition level in Tigray now is over 22%, which is roughly the same as we saw in Somalia in 2011 at the start of the Somali famine. So it's very significant. Anything over 15% is very significant. What we'll see is the effect of hunger and starvation coupled with the problems of medical problems, of chronic diseases, lack of vaccinations. 200,000 children have missed their vaccinations, for example, in Tigray alone. So the combination of lack of medical care, most of the health institutions there are inoperable, and lack of food will mean that people will start to die.
That's UN Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths. Hardin Lang is Vice President of Refugees International, one of the 30 international and local organizations that issued an open letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and permanent representatives of the Security Council, asking them to take urgent action to end violence and farming in Tigray. International Edition's Jackson Vugani asked him for an update on what many say is a deliberate blockade of aid going to the region.
I think we're in a situation where the ongoing famine conditions and humanitarian crisis inside of Tigray itself is now being augmented by additional sort of fighting and displacement in surrounding regions. What we've seen over the last couple of months is the conflict begin to spread out beyond the borders of Tigray into Amhara and Afar. Inside of Tigray itself, what we've seen is a continuation of the blockade, what amounts to a blockade by the government of Ethiopia. And there, you know, the situation for over 5 million people living inside, hunger remains an incredibly acute condition with a million plus people living in something approaching famine conditions. And the number of an amount of humanitarian assistance that's getting in is still just a fraction of what's required.
30 organizations, including yours, issued a letter to the UN Secretary General. Can you tell us a little bit what this letter is asking for?
What we're trying to do is increase sort of the pressure and public awareness around the fact that this crisis inside of Tigray is continuing to degenerate, with the goal of putting real pressure on the United Nations Secretary General and perhaps more importantly members of the Security Council to actually take more concrete action to get involved in the resolution of the crisis. In particular, what we're looking for is first a humanitarian ceasefire of some form, and that's not just the government of Ethiopia and forces allied with it, but that's also Tigrayan defense forces who are at the moment the ones who have the initiative on the battlefield, not only outside immediately outside Tigray, but also in some of the surrounding regions. So we want to see all the parties agree to a ceasefire. We want to see the Ethiopian government very quickly open up access of the blockade. So right now, since the blockade went into effect, the UN estimates that it's about 8,000 trucks or so of aid to go in. That's about 100 trucks a day. So far in that period of time, the last couple of months, we've seen about 400 plus trucks go through. So that gives you a feeling for how bad it is. We want to see some humanitarian monitors deployed to be able to watch what's happening inside of Tigray and watch the aid being delivered, and really encourage, finally, as a final step, more increased an inclusive political process that will bring all the parties to the conflict to the table across Ethiopia.
That was Hardin Lang, the Vice President of Refugees International. He was speaking with my colleague, Jackson Vunganyi, in Washington. This is the Voice of America. Former Japanese Foreign Minister Fumio Kishida has won the governing party's leadership election and is set to become the country's next prime minister. Kishida replaces outgoing party leader, Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga, who is stepping down after serving only 1 year. In his victory speech, Kishida vowed to tackle national crises, including COVID-19, the pandemic-battered economy, and the declining population, while pursuing a vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific that counters Chinese assertiveness in the region. North Korea says it successfully tested a new hypersonic missile as it continues to expand its military capabilities. The missile tested earlier Tuesday was North Korea's third launch this month and took place as it tries to pressure Washington and Seoul over long-stalled negotiations about its nuclear weapons. North Korean state media said the missile met technical requirements during its first flight test and implied it was being developed to carry nuclear weapons. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A World Health Organization investigation has found that dozens of women were allegedly sexually abused and exploited by international staff and locals hired to to respond to an Ebola outbreak in eastern DRC. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization appointed a five-member independent commission in October 2020 to investigate allegations of sexual abuse by its staff in Congo's Ituri and North and South Kivu provinces. Senior WHO officials called the results released Tuesday horrifying and heartbreaking. The commission found that more than 80 alleged cases of sexual abuse occurred during the outbreak between August 2018 and June 2020. Most of the victims were uneducated women ages 13 to 43. Commission member Malik Koulibaly says most of the women who testified said they had been forced to exchange sex for the promise of a job. He says some of the sexual exploitation and abuse was organized through a network operating through the local branch that recruited people to work on the Ebola response. He speaks through an interpreter.
Most victims did not get the jobs that they were promised in spite of the fact that they agreed to sexual relations. Some women declared that they continued to be sexually harassed by men and they were obliged to have sexual relations to be able to keep their job or even to be paid.
Women who were interviewed said none of the perpetrators had used birth control, and some who became pregnant said the men who had abused them forced them to have abortions. The investigation found 21 of the 83 alleged perpetrators were WHO staff, some Congolese, some from abroad. The other alleged perpetrators were contractors such as drivers and security personnel. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus describes the document as harrowing reading.
The conduct it describes is a sickening betrayal of the people we serve. It's my top priority to ensure that the perpetrators are not excused but are held to account. And I will take personal responsibility for making whatever changes we need to make to prevent this happening in future.
Tedros says four WHO staff so far have been fired and two have been put on administrative leave. He says the alleged perpetrators of rape will be referred to national authorities in Congo for investigation. The WHO chief says that all victims of sexual exploitation and abuse will have access to the services they need, including medical and psychosocial support, and that assistance for their children's education will also be provided. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The pandemic has made Spain's affordable housing crisis worse, and civil organizations are now pressuring the government to pass a housing law that includes making available vacant foreclosed homes. The push is causing new friction between the Spanish political factions and raising concerns among real estate investors. Jonathan Speer narrates this report by Alfonso Bieto in Barcelona.
Bibiana Murillo, a Colombian immigrant, single mother, has an eviction order. Undocumented and with no means to get an apartment the usual way, she decided to occupy a foreclosed home that is the property of a bank.
One lives with one's nerves on end, with stress, anxiety. One doesn't know at what moment they are going to come and evict.
Bibiana was desperate to find shelter for her two children. She found support from the group known as the Platform for Those Affected by Mortgages, or PAH. The organization is putting pressure on the government to pass a measure known as the Law to Guarantee the Right to Decent and Adequate Housing, also supported by numerous civic organizations.
In Spain, if you have a foreclosure process, the bank keeps your house. They keep all the money, of course, that you have paid until then. And in addition, you own the bank a debt because you have not been able to pay it. So this is completely different from the rest of the world.
The organization fights against evictions and gives legal advice to those who decide to squat in foreclosed vacant homes owned by the banks. The group refers to the squatting as reappropriation and wants the government to force owners to put the homes on the market for sale or rent them out to people with low incomes. Conservatives call it a violation of private property rights.
On this matter, we are completely against. It is a kick in the pants because respect for private property is fundamental. But at the same time, we must pay attention to the fact there are people who have no housing.
False information about squatting that has jumped from social networks to the mainstream media has led people to believe that their homes can be easily occupied. That has alarmed property owners and caused a jump in business for security-related products and services. Currently, Spain's largest advertiser is a security company.
This led me to install security cameras.
Eduard Soler has a block of 14 apartments. He has not had to deal with squatters, but hearing that they could show up at any time has prompted him to take precautions. Mediation companies have also seen a boom in recent months. Owners hire the services of these companies to get rid of the squatters, sometimes using questionable methods.
Since the pandemic began, business has doubled or tripled.
Activists want the government to force corporate real estate owners to put the homes on the market and offer social rent to vulnerable groups. The alternative to that is the citizen reappropriation of those empty homes in the hands of financial institutions. Activists say 80% of the homes occupied by squatters are owned by corporations or investment firms. They estimate that thousands such homes in Spain are sitting empty, like these apartments, where the bank evicted the previous owner and installed a security door to keep out squatters.
Empty apartments without people and people struggling to find a place to live.
Spain has the smallest stock of low-income housing for rent of all European countries. The country's central bank says the mortgage bailout of 2012 cost Spanish taxpayers $76 million, 65% of which was never repaid. For Alfonso Beato in Barcelona, John Speer, VOA News.
Residents of the Mayan community in Guatemala prevented experts on Tuesday from beginning to exhume the remains of more than 100 children believed to have been buried clandestinely. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
In Guatemala, a search is on for the remains of indigenous children that were massacred in the 1980s civil war. But on Tuesday, search efforts were blocked. Residents of a Mayan community in the remote village of Chaul stopped authorities from exhuming remains of more than 100 children believed to be buried in unmarked graves. Little explanation was offered as to why. Yet a survivor, Analfo Oclaj, who was at the site on Tuesday, said that among the opposition were former members of the country's armed forces, which has been accused of carrying out the massacre.
Siendo yo un niño, me torturaron y me tiraron.
When I was a child, they tortured me and threw me into a well full of water and army feces. I emerged from the dead. I am not afraid of death, but before they kill me in a cowardly way, they will give me the bodies of the others.
He says they want to oppose justice. Reuters could not independently confirm the allegations by Oclaj. A Guatemalan army spokesman did not respond to a request for comment. The massacre, one of many targeting Mayan communities during the civil war, occurred on May 21, 1988. Witnesses say members of the armed forces captured hundreds of residents and separated the children from their parents. According to Oclaj, 116 children between the ages of 2 and 15 were tortured and thrown into what was then a well, where they drowned. However, there is no official record of the number of victims or clarity about the motivations behind the killings. The Guatemalan military has been accused of conducting a genocide campaign against indigenous peoples during the conflict.
Deaths come knocking for a last time for the ivory-billed woodpecker and almost two dozen other birds, fish and other species. The U.S. government is declaring them extinct. It's a rare move for wildlife officials to give up hope on a plant or animal, but scientists say climate change threatens to make extinctions more common as it adds to the pressures facing imperiled species. The factors behind this latest and largest batch of extinctions vary: urbanization, water pollution, logging, in each case, humans were the ultimate cause. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a splendid evening.